are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, March 11th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nico Hines, London editor of the Daily Beast, on just the horrible story of how Margaret Thatcher's government covered up a VIP pedophilia ring. Then we will speak to Lori Chadgett, a parent of public school, elementary public school children who are as part of at least thousands who are marching in Albany today, fighting against Andrew Cuomo's attack on public education. We said once he banned fracking that he probably turned to his advisor and said, now at least I can really rape the public school system. Well, he's doing it, folks. We will talk to a parent who is protesting. Important lesson, because if it's going to happen here in this blue state, folks, you know it's coming to your home, too. Also on the program today, Republican senators, a couple of them, saying it may not have been such a good idea to write that letter to Iran after all. Meanwhile,
didn't work out like in the manner in which it was like planned.
Well, I think there was probably a significant lack of planning.
Dude, also, Tom, what the hell?
Also on the program today, Digital Archiving Compliance Gate continues. Sorry, somebody's got to put a name to this scandal. I think we've got it. Digital Archiving Compliance Gate. Yes. Continues unabated, folks. I have some thoughts on whether or not we're going to see this over the next 20 months. As in the event that Hillary Clinton does indeed run for president. And a couple of notes on the way that this Wisconsin so-called right-to-work bill was reported on, which I think is indicative of one of the problems that we have in fighting this type of legislation going forward. Folks, as you know, we are engaged in a campaign of our own. Now, I know that there's a sense of inevitability and that in many respects we scared a lot of people out of the race. But the Majority Report is in the running for the best podcast in politics and news for the fourth year in a row. And I'll tell you something, there's something fundamentally different this year about these awards. In addition to the fact that they're now backed by a different organization, which I'm not quite sure has been an upgrade in terms of the way that they're running this award, but be that as it may, podcasts have become generally more popular and well-known. And so each year the competition gets stiffer, and the relevance of the award becomes more important, and that's why we're pushing it so hard. And Michael today was like, I don't think I've ever seen you have this level of enthusiasm for anything in terms of expressing some measure of ambition to achieve something. And it's really, I'm more concerned about not winning than I am about winning in this situation.
You always have to frame it in the negative for Sam.
Well, no, it's not that. It's just that we are the best news in politics.
That's our slot.
That's right.
You got to keep us there.
And that's right. And we need to, it's, now I know what it feels like to be a billionaire. You're just constantly worried that you may sink down to 100 multimillionaire. go to podcastawards.com. Vote for us in news and politics. Also, Best of the Left is up for People's Choice. So vote for them in that category. And they have sent a lot of listeners to this program over the years. And Jay, of course, has been also very helpful just in general in setting up this show. So vote for us in Best News in Politics. And then check your email because they will verify it. And also, I've been told by listener Noble Baker that a couple of times that they see that it says success. Thank you for your vote. Check back to tomorrow to vote. Come back tomorrow to vote again. Participants will be required to verify their vote. So you got to check your email. Sometimes that goes into your spam filter. Just check it. It'll take a second. And also make sure you see the word success after you vote, because sometimes it's a little bit hinky. So thank you, listener Noble Baker, for that. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nico Hines, London editor of The Daily Beast, on this bizarre story, which I think is, at the very least, illustrative of an era we're living in where there is two tiers of justice. Maybe we've always been living in that era, but it is, I think to a certain extent, we've been perhaps maybe living in an era of delusion that there isn't two sets of justice. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Nico Hines. He's the London editor of The Daily Beast, and we are talking to him in London at the moment. Nico, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So this story is incredibly disturbing that you've published in The Daily Beast. I guess it was about a week ago. It is about a VIP pedophile network that was, I guess, I don't know, embedded is the right word, but it was within the British government. Tell us how this story came to light.
Well, how it's come out is a really important part of this whole alleged cover-up. All the way back in the mid-1980s, there were allegations and rumors about senior members of the British government and about what they may or may not have been getting up to in their private time. You have to remember this was a very different world back then. Homosexuality had only been legalized relatively recently, and the age of consent was 21. So there was a kind of a shadowy gay world in any case. So some of these kind of more serious or I shouldn't compare the two, but because there was a veil of secrecy and a veil of criminality around some people's private lives, this was somehow allowed to go on unchecked. Yet there were rumours. Now, media, newspapers, some of whom tried to cover this at the time, but they were never able to, either because the police rushed in to stop them or just because of Britain's very strict libel laws. If you're going to make an accusation that somebody was breaking the law and in such a serious way, you have to have a lot of proof in order to be able to back up your assertion.
Now, so this scandal, or I should say this pedophile network, we're not talking. I mean, are you saying that the we're talking about 20-year-olds, and it is, or are we talking about young children here?
No, we're talking about people from the earliest age that I've seen in allegations that have gone to the police, about 9 years old. So, okay. Yeah, we're talking about serious, serious claims. The reason I mention the older people is just because it gives some context to understand. There was a place called Dolphin Square, which is located near Westminster, near the Houses of Parliament, and a lot of MPs lived there because obviously they have their main homes in the parts of the country that they come from and that they represent. But when they're in London to do political business, they have flats in this place. And it was known that there were some gay parties that had older people in them that were partially secret. But what is now being alleged is that there were, in fact, serious paedophile rings also operating in this block of apartments.
Okay, so let me just see if I can clarify your point here. Is that because this was at a time where there was, I guess, essentially, gay people were emancipated in some way, at least in the context of the law, that there were still sort of these vestiges of a social, I guess, perspective where you don't really look into what's going on in the personal lives of people because what they may be engaged in may be technically illegal but is not necessarily problematic. And some of that, I guess, modus operandi sort of intersected with what was clearly a different species, i.e., you know, pedophilia. But those sort of constructs were still sort of like were blurred because of that.
Exactly. It just gave a cover story. So you knew that people, MPs, senior MPs who worked for the Margaret Thatcher government, were going off doing things that they didn't want everyone to know about. But you just kind of assumed that it was something that was technically illegal or perhaps frowned upon, or, you know, this was a time when there weren't publicly gay MPs. So you just imagined that what they were doing was actually perfectly reasonable behavior, even if it was technically illegal. But in fact, it now turns out that there were serious crimes being committed.
Okay, so in 1983, you write, Jeffrey Dickens, a controversial MP. I'm not clear, obviously, as an American, I'm not too up on my on the profiles of members of Parliament, particularly in the 80s, but frankly in the 90s or the aughts, for that matter. But he handed a file containing the names of alleged perpetrators to Leon Britton. Who was Leon Britton?
Right. So Leon Britton is the Home Secretary, which I suppose the most similar position in the U.S. would be kind of director of Homeland Security or something like that, someone who's in charge of Britain's police, Britain's intelligence agencies, but also kind of border control. So a very, very, very influential person in terms of someone who was able to put in place, kind of was able to use his influence to make sure that those law enforcement agencies were following his will.
Okay, and so what did he do with this? This file of claims.
Well, that's one of the hotly contested things that's run and run on this. Now, Jeffrey Dickens publicly said that there was a suggestions of there being a paedophile ring in London amongst politicians at the time. Now, most people thought, you know, Jeffrey Dickens was a kind of outspoken, flamboyant kind of a guy. Most people thought he was probably exaggerating or perhaps had got the wrong end of the stick. Nobody necessarily took his claims seriously. Nonetheless, he passed his dossier of evidence to Leon Britton, the Home Secretary, and nothing publicly was ever heard again from that. Now, we subsequently found out that he wrote to Jeffrey Dickens later to explain that his officials did find enough evidence in there to consider it worthwhile to carry out further investigations, but that's the last that we hear about it. the whereabouts of that file is a great mystery. There was an investigation last year ordered by the current British government to try and discover where that file was, and that file has been destroyed. Now, we don't know who destroyed it, we don't know when it was destroyed, but the fact is it is no longer in existence.
Okay, and we should say that this guy, Leon Britton, has passed away. I mean, is that why? Okay, and then tell us who Don Hale is, and what was his role in, I guess, this revelation.
Don Hale was a local newspaper editor. He worked in Bury, so outside of London. But the reason he kind of comes into the story is because one of his local politicians, who was a senior Labour politician at the time, went to him and said, look, I've got evidence about these paedophile rings. Now, she wasn't necessarily saying that these people were all active paedophiles, but she was saying that there was a group called the Paedophile Information Exchange, which was working within Westminster, kind of promoting or working to improve rights for paedophiles. She had evidence that these people were working within Westminster, and she wanted the big national press to run a story about it, but they were all too scared to run a story about it. So she went to her local MP, her local newspaper, a guy who she knew well, Don Hale, and gave him that evidence. He was sceptical and at least worried about how he'd be able to use the story, but he thought the least thing I can do is I can run a story saying, you know, well-known local politician Barbara Castle is worried that there's a paedophile ring in Westminster, and she says that it's being investigated by the British government. He thought he'd get away with doing that, so he started to make a few calls to some of those people named in the dossier. No sooner did he do that, but a politician arrived at the office the very next morning, threatening him, shouting at him, demanding that he hand over the files. He refused to hand over those files. And then the very next day, police officers from something called Special Branch, which is a sort of high-up intelligence, Cold War-era police super squad, arrived at the office and took away all the papers, took away all the evidence, and said that if he were to ever repeat anything that was found within these stolen documents, that he would be jailed.
Wow. And so he didn't. I mean, how do we know his story today?
Well, he decided that, you know, it was a fair cop in a sense, because he knew that these documents were stolen, or at least were not supposed to have been shown outside of the Home Office. They had, you know, for your eyes only and classified written on the papers. So he knew that it was true that he could get in trouble if he used them. And he didn't have any way to prove that these allegations were true. So even when he was approached a few years later by the News of the World, a famous tabloid newspaper in Britain owned by Rupert Murdoch, about similar allegations, he refused to repeat them again then because he was afraid. You know, he had a family, he didn't want to go to jail. It was only when this story began to really explode in 2012 in Britain, when an MP used parliamentary privilege, which means you're allowed to make a claim against an individual that would be considered libelous if it was written in a newspaper or if it was published or discussed on the radio. He used parliamentary privilege to say in the British House of Commons that some of these allegations ought to be examined. And that then kicked into gear the British media into reinvestigating and re-examining some of these things. And the crucial difference is that quite a lot of these men have subsequently died. And so you're now able to repeat some of these allegations, which were never proved in a court of law at the time.
Wow. And so, I mean, following, I guess, the member of the House of Commons sort of saying that we need to more investigation in this, Hale reports this stuff. Where is it? Where are we now with this? Or I should say, before we get to that, how much did Margaret Thatcher, I mean, how high up did this go?
That's, again, something that more and more details of that are emerging as the weeks go on at the moment, because people are plunging back through the archives and finding old reports, finding old classified files, and individuals who were involved with Margaret Thatcher are starting to speak out. So we had one of her bodyguards has come out and said that he warned her about one of her close aides, that lots of allegations have been made against him. We know that Sir Peter Hayman, who was one of the top guys at MI6, one of Britain's main spy agencies, was also caught with paedophile material. We know that she was told about that, and we can see in her hand on a note that was found earlier this year that she says that this shouldn't be made public.
Wait a second. I'm sorry. What is that last part? Is she found there was a note? Oh, a note that she wrote in her handwriting.
That's right, saying that this shouldn't be made public. So she knew that these allegations had been made. She knew that this guy was responsible not for abusing children, but for having paedophile obscene materials. And she wrote to one of her advisors, "Oh no, let's make sure this doesn't come out." It then emerged this weekend that another of these high-profile abusers, a man called Cyril Smith, and I advise the listeners to look him up, because he's one of the most extraordinary-looking men you'll ever see. Huge, fat man, weighed about 400 pounds, and used to wear kind of these big braces and suspenders. He looked kind of like a cartoonish figure of a bad guy. And it turned out he was a bad guy. Something like several hundred complaints were filed against him by boys over a period of decades. And again, she was warned that allegations had been made against him of this nature. And she went ahead and gave him a knighthood anyway. So he died as Sir Cyril Smith.
So what is happening? I mean, how much is this? I mean, your story, frankly, is the only reporting I've read about this in the States here. There may be other pieces. I haven't come across them. It's certainly not a story that is making big ripples. How big of a story is this in Great Britain? I mean, it just seems. I mean, there's two things that seem really sort of shocking to me. One is the cover-up. Two is, you know, why are there so many pedophiles in and around these governmental positions? I mean, this is just it just seems bizarre to me in both instances. But what kind of response are you getting in Great Britain?
It's one of those things that has bubbled and bubbled and bubbled. And it's actually, I think, it's one of the upsides of the internet and people being able to publish information and share information in a way that was never possible before. So what you had in the 1980s and perhaps in the early 1990s was newspapers hearing rumors, hearing suggestions, and perhaps even hearing first-hand evidence from one or two people, one or two victims, that someone had abused them or had broken the law in some way. But not necessarily there being no photographic evidence or there being no video evidence, so it's very difficult with libel laws to be able to report that. But what's now happened is that people who are either survivors themselves or who are kind of self-appointed sleuths have put together a lot of this information into great folders and files and websites where they've collated this evidence. And it's only become apparent that that there were so many people active at the same time.
But it's because, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, just because major newspapers were afraid to do it. And because, frankly, you know, as you found yourself, it just doesn't sound believable. It doesn't sound like it could be true. And how could you possibly write that some of the most senior people in the country are paedophiles just based on the word of one or two children who you can't prove are telling the truth?
So is there, in my mind, it would cause me to question two things. One is, I mean, just a fundamental question of just, you know, there's all sorts of issues of what else, you know, how many other people are being protected for what and in what dynamic and how long this has been going on, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to address that in a second. But what about the libel laws? I mean, I don't know that Americans are quite aware of just how different your libel law situation is in Great Britain. And I wonder if people are questioning the value of those or whether or not they need to be reformed in some way, because the idea that this could go on and people would be afraid of reporting it seems to me very problematic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of people do think that. There's also a kind of counter-argument. I don't know whether you guys have followed. We've had this big phone hacking scandal over here. And, you know, yes. Rupert Murdoch and a lot of the British tabloids have come under fire for writing too much, making too many fallacious claims about celebrities and about people. So there's also a strong counter-movement, as it were. But, you know, I think you can look too much into blaming why weren't the media reporting on this. And perhaps there's a valid point in that. But what the real crux of it is, why weren't the police investigating this? Why weren't these people coming up in court? Because there was evidence. People like Cyril Smith was caught with hardcore pornography in his car and yet was allowed to walk free from a police station because there was a phone call from someone in some high-powered office in London that told the local police officers, oh, do you know what? Do us a favor. Just let this guy walk on his way.
Has there been any rethink? I mean, do you anticipate this is going to impact Margaret Thatcher's legacy? And I don't know that it really, I don't know how great her legacy is, frankly, anyways, in Great Britain, for that matter. But I mean, is this going to impact her legacy? And are people talking about some form of reform within the government structures? I mean, there was a quote that you used in your piece, which as I was reading it, I said, this sounds like it would be from House of Cards. In fact, it was a storyline pretty close in House of Cards from basically a whip saying, you know, when members of parliament come to us with these type of problems, we're excited about it because it means we help them out and now we own these guys, essentially. Is there any talk of, like, we got to figure out a way to make sure that can't happen?
No, that's exactly right. And what we have got now, and even this in itself has become a massive problem, is there's an enormous inquiry has been launched into how this was covered up, how this went on. It was announced over a year ago, I think, now, and yet has not even sat for a single hearing yet because there have been so many arguments about who's going to be in charge and who will be able to be responsible for making sure this is an honest and open inquiry. Eventually, they've had to get rid of two panel potential kind of judges who were going to be in charge of it because it turned out that they were friends or lived in the same neighbourhood for some of the men who were supposedly caught up in it. So we've now got a judge from New Zealand who's going to be flown over as an independent adjudicator. And it will be her job to go through and to examine how these things were allowed to happen and what should be done in order to make sure that they don't happen again.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it just seems to me, too, that, you know, in this instance, it is pedophilia. But one wonders how many other violations, crimes, scandals are quashed or investigations of which are quashed so that these can be used as chits of power in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it happens a lot in the US, perhaps not on these particular grounds, but I'm sure similar things happen. But it's always been worse in Britain, I think, because, you know, we do have a different kind of a society here. I don't know if you've seen any of those pictures, school pictures of David Cameron and Boris Johnson, our London mayor, and George Osborne, our top treasury guy. You know, they were all friends at university. They went to school at similar schools, if not the same school. And we've got a real problem in Britain of a kind of establishment in a way that I suppose, you know, the Clintons would aspire to, where there's a kind of closed part of society who've known each other all their lives. And yes, when one of them gets in trouble, they're going to close ranks and they're going to try and look out for each other, try and make sure that, not just because they want to do them a favour as friends or as colleagues, but because they think that it would look bad to the rest of watching Britain if it turned out that people who are in this establishment maybe shouldn't be trusted in the way that they are.
It's fascinating. And, you know, it just go, if molesting and abusing small children is not enough to have people in your social circle say, we should blow the whistle on this. So one wonders what else they can get away with. But I appreciate your time, Nico Hines. The piece is in the Daily Beast. I presume hopefully we'll see more reporting from you going forward on this, because it's a bizarre and fascinating, disturbing story. I appreciate your coming on and talk to us about it.
Thank you. If you look out later this week, there should be another piece up on the Daily Beast about a U.S. connection.
Interesting. All right. Well, we will check that out. And, of course, we're going to link to your first piece at Majority FM. All right. Nico Hines, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks.
A U.S. connection. Now, we can't have the Tories be exposed for their child molestation, because that might disrupt the Contras bringing drugs into the American ghettos. So let's just quiet that right up.
I'm sure there was a lot of guys in Hollywood who were doing much worse things. Isn't that right, Nancy?
One time we went to a place in Melrose, and, well, that would be quite a shock
there
for
the
was average...
I remember a couple of parties up in the Hollywood Hills where, well, let's just say there was a couple of zoo animals that we brought home that had quite a bewildered look on their face.
Bestiality is an interesting but highly overrated experience.
Now let's go inflict some pain on some poor people and drum up some racial animosity. What do you say, Nancy?
It's important that nothing distract from that, including some of our British friends getting up to some hijinks.
That's right. As long as she's destroying the unions, let's keep our priorities straight. We don't want those commies. It's one thing to be a pedophile, but God forbid you should promote some type of egalitarian principles or overly restrictive taxation. That would be very problematic.
That would be wrong. I don't care if you don't touch little boys, Boris. You don't believe in freedom.
Now, of course, I know there is a theory about the liberty of one's body. But children are basically the property of their parents until they are 18, so...
And any other enterprising capitalist that may have access to them in the anteroom.
That's right. If you don't want to be molested by a member of parliament, caveat emptor. Jesus. This is just a horrible story. Obviously, we're not making light of the story. It's just incredibly disturbing. And I don't know how many hundreds of people just devastated by it, just in the context of this story. But what's amazing about it is that just the sort of the capacity of the establishment. And there's no reason to believe that this dynamic doesn't work here in this country in some fashion, not necessarily for, pedophilia rings. And I just, you know, that nexus too, like, why are there that many pedophiles in British society that it's inevitable you're going to have the head of this or a government agency or this many prominent MPs or a protege to Margaret Thatcher? It's just unbelievable. All right. Well, we got to take a break. And, it appears we're going to be talking to Michelle Cupper. She is a community activist and a parent of she's a community education council district member in New York City. She is up at these protests in Albany. I want to talk to her because, again, this is an issue. The attacks on public education is one that we followed quite a bit. And if it's happening in this state, you can be sure that it's coming to a state and near you. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Michelle Cupper. She is a member of the Community Education Council of District 15 and a parent of an elementary school child in Brooklyn, here in Brooklyn, I should say. I'm speaking to her. She is in Albany. Michelle, what are you doing up in Albany today?
Hi. Yeah, I'm in Albany right now. I'm actually on the parade route with a bunch of public school advocates. And we are here to oppose Governor Cuomo's latest proposal that he has rolled into the budget vote.
Tell us what that proposal is.
Well, there are numerous facets to the proposal. One of them, of course, is that he's looking to raise the charter cap by 100 schools. He's looking to increase the amount of he's looking to increase the percentage that a student's test score plays into teacher evaluations. A teacher evaluation will be 50% of, based on student test scores if the proposal goes through. He's also looking privatize public schools by offering tax credits and kind of a voucher system so that students can pull out of public schools and go to private schools. So we're here to oppose all of these issues.
All right. Well, let's,
obviously, let me also say, of course, in the funding is the primary issue. He has owed billions of dollars to New York City and New York State schools for years, and he's holding this money hostage. We won't get this money unless this proposal passes.
All right. So explain that dynamic. What does that mean? He's owed billions of dollars to public schools.
Well, in the early 90s, there was a lawsuit that campaigned for fiscal equity that was looking to bring some equitable funding conditions to students. There's thousands of dollars of difference per student. When you look at students in the richest schools and the poorest schools across the state, you're looking at like an $8,000 per student difference of, you know, how much money gets spent. And the Campaign for Fiscal Equity is looking to remedy that. So back in the early 90s, it came out that yes, in fact, it was unconstitutional. Children were not receiving a sound basic education. And so they were starting to release some money to the schools. And then when the recession hit, that money it came to a halt. And now there's a surplus in the budget, and we're looking for that money now to get released to our public schools.
And Cuomo has basically, through the budget process, put some major strings on that, which is, let's start with them, raising the cap on the number of charter schools. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. That just basically means we're going to publicly fund essentially private schools that don't have the same level of accountability, don't have to serve the same range of children in terms of ones that have perhaps learning disabilities or learning challenges. or behavioral challenges, and we don't have to basically pay teachers or there's a whole raft of issues with charters that we've talked about in this school, but lifting the cap just means more of those problems.
That's right. That's right. And charter schools are not kind of handling the same population that public schools at large do. And we see, I mean, you know, the relationship between Andrew Cuomo and Success Academies. You can't make a mistake about the fact that the hedge fund backers are giving him tons of money for his political campaign. And he's speaking at Success Academy, you know, fundraisers. This is where that is the driving force of what's going on there.
Yes, we know that Ken Langone met with him, I guess it was maybe it was over a year ago, and which sort of preceded his first appearance at a charter school rally. Let's talk about this teacher evaluation thing, because I don't know if this is as quite as obvious to people. The implications, walk us through what it means that you're going to tie teacher evaluations to these test scores. Because I think some people think, well, that seems a fairly obvious thing to do.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and this certainly isn't about not wanting quality assessments for our children. And it's certainly not about not wanting quality evaluations for our teachers. We have to have something in place, right, to be able to call out bad teachers, especially in low-income, impoverished neighborhoods. That, however, these tests are not where it's at. First of all, these exams are very flawed, and it's an invalid practice to use what's called value-added measures to grade teachers, because it's impossible to isolate a teacher's effectiveness from all of the other factors that affect student test scores. So when you have a teacher whose evaluation is based 50% on a student test score, those teachers are going to feel really under pressure across schools to increase the test prep going on. And this, of course, increases anxiety at schools about the test. The curriculum is narrowed across the board. More and more programs that are considered extras now, even things like science, right? To think of that as an extra seems ridiculous to me. Arts and music and all sorts of clubs. A lot of that will get cut because there's more and more pressure on these tests, and teachers are under the gun then to get the test scores up. Think about what children get focused on. You're a very low scoring student. Is it even worth spending time on you if you can't get those scores up? Maybe you're a very high achieving student. Is it worth spending any time on you because your score is not going to move if you're already a 4? So these are just a couple of the major concerns that that kind of a proposal will have on our classroom. Dire consequences.
What's really stunning too is that the people who push this this sort of data driven I guess method of evaluating teachers, these are people who it would seem would be the first to recognize that, like, of course, all you're basically saying to a teacher is exactly that. Ignore the really low performers, ignore the really high performers, just get the median average up and do nothing but teach to the test. It doesn't matter if these kids can open up a paper bag or spend a quarter at a store. It doesn't matter anything but teach to that test. And any teacher under this type of regime would be foolish not to spend at least 50% of their time, and perhaps even more, because look, this could be the only thing, that, needle that they could move at that point, if they could move it. So you'd be,
you might be the best teacher in the world, the most effective, amazing teacher in the world, and you get put into a school with lots of pre-existing conditions like poverty and hunger and all of those things, and you might be doing all sorts of meaningful things with those children, changing their lives, right, in incredible ways. And yet there might not be the kind of growth in test scores specifically. I'm seeing that a lot of good teachers are not going to want to go into the toughest school situations.
And
so therefore those communities lose out the most.
Indeed, right? You don't put yourself at a disadvantage if you know that there are other factors that are going to implicate those test scores. Why would you put yourself in those most challenging of circumstances? And really, what we're talking about is just turning our school system into an extended Kaplan test prep type of place.
Yes, that's right.
And there's a reason why we don't just send our kids to Kaplan Test Prep. That presumably
right.
you
public
want them.
Schools are supposed, you know, you want your child to have a really meaningful, engaged, incredible school experience, not just going to learn how to take a test.
All right. So tell us about the tax credits and vouchers. Just how much money are we talking about? And I think this also is something that people are fairly familiar with this dynamic. You take money out of public schools and mm-hmm. basically send people to private schools with them. Vouchers are supplemented by other people's income. So you're basically, again, screwing over lower income kids, and you're also destroying the public school foundations. How much money are we talking about in this budget?
I actually don't know the answer to that question. I don't know exactly how much money we're talking about, but I think you're exactly right, is that we're basically looking to gut public schools and just the whole common good. This idea, you know, where public schools came from, is that that public schools are meant to serve everyone, and it's going to increase inequity across the board and further segregate our school system.
So give us a sense of what the timing is of all mm-hmm. this. Are we in the process, and what can people do about it?
Okay, well, I don't know if you saw in the New York Times yesterday or the day before that the Assembly did come out very strongly opposed. The state assembly came out and rejected the proposal. So I think we need to keep the pressure on. The assembly is quite progressive, and it's really, I know there's quite a number of them. I just saw a letter from Catherine Nolan, who's the chair of the Education Committee, and it said, you know, she was opposing the plan, and it was signed by 72 assembly members. So we need to keep on working with them. The vote needs to stop there, you know, before it heads to the Senate. And hopefully we can get this thing. Yeah, I think there's going to be negotiations happening. So a lot of us are here in Albany right now to meet with our legislators and talk about how to best negotiate this proposal.
And my understanding is tomorrow in New York, there is going to be citywide protests. Are those going to happen across the state as well?
Yeah, well, tomorrow they're happening across the city. As far as I know, they're happening across the state on the 26th. So, yeah, tomorrow, I know, at PS29 and a ton of schools across District 15, as well as around the entire city, there are events of parents and teachers, students coming together to hold hands to protect their schools as a symbolic shield from Governor Cuomo's proposals. Rallies, signs, chanting. It's going to be we're doing ours in the morning. Some are doing theirs after school tomorrow. So, yeah, those are all happening.
I believe in my daughter's school, it's going to be in the morning, so I will be attending first thing.
Awesome.
Now, give me your perspective on opting out of the tests. I mean, this is something that I know that we are at my house wrestling with this idea as well. Why are people opting out of the tests? What are the implications of it?
Sure. In my opinion, I feel like opting out right now in the press is being sort of played up as kind of this radical action that we're all kind of opposed to what's going on in education. To me, it is not radical at all. To me, it's the most common sense action that we can take in response to what is radical, is this proposal and this, all of these things coming out of Albany, that it's not educators making these decisions, it's politicians making these decisions about what's going on in classrooms. So I am opting out my third grade daughter, and I know there are a number of others in her class. There are students I know in other grades opting out. I know at schools around District 15, we just conducted a forum last week called Opt In, Opt Out, Time to Choose. And we hosted Carol Burris, Principal of the Year in 2013, also Jeanette Duderman, who organized Long Island Opt Out. And, there were 30,000 parents on Long Island last year who opted out. So we're kind of teaming up with them, looking for ways to organize and get the word out that this is the way that makes sense to get our message across. We can rally, we can hold signs, but denying the data on which this machine runs is, I think, going to be the most effective way to really see change. We already know that where there has been resistance like this, we've seen policies rolled back. Seattle, Washington, there was a huge boycott, right? You know, so I think we need to see, and, you know, last year there was a lot of resistance to the testing right in New York City, and they did remove student test scores from promotions Middle schools are not using it by and large for admission. We have seen some real changes when you show resistance to the testing in this way.
And so the hope is that if enough people opt out, there will be a sort of a statistically speaking, the aside from all the other problems with testing, statistically speaking, there will be very sort of, I guess, shaky grounds on which to rely upon those numbers. You obviously have a smaller sample. If you have a class of 29 kids and only 10 take the test, it's really hard to argue that you're getting a good measure as to whether, even on your on those sort of data-driven terms, that you're getting any type
that's
of
right.
accurate measure of just that's even
right.
how people would do on the test. And so that's the theory
that's right.
there.
And in order to get a growth score, each teacher needs to have 16 scores, and that's combined in BLA and math.
So wait a sec. I mean, I'm sorry. Say that again.
In order to get a growth score for a teacher to get that, for evaluation, his or her evaluation to be tied to student test scores, there needs to be 16 test scores total. And that's a combination of ELA and math in order for that to happen. So if there are fewer than that in her class, in each teacher's class, then there will not be. Then there will not be a growth
score. All right.
So
just to be clear on that, if there's 30 kids in the class and they take both an ELA and a math test, that's a total of 60 tests.
60 scores. Yeah.
6-0.
Right.
And the teacher needs at least 1-6.
That's correct.
Okay. So you'd need basically 24 kids to basically opt out.
That's right. So you need 8 students to take the test.
Okay, for them to get those scores.
Right, and the fact that a lot of people are concerned about having high-achieving students opt out, but if you're using a growth-based model, that really isn't a concern, right? You know, if your student is a high-achieving student and you feel like it's going to do well on a test, how is it that next year they're going to show, you know, chances are, since there's so many other factors that affect test performance, when you're looking at a growth model, sort of high achieving versus low achieving, really, there's not such a concern. Sorry if that doesn't make sense.
Well, I want to wish you, Michelle, I appreciate your taking the time to talk to us about this, and good luck to all of you up there marching. Thank you on behalf of myself as a public school parent. Thanks for being up there and marching. And, you know, I think for people across the country, frankly, if it can happen in New York State, which is a pretty blue state as they go, this is something that certainly could happen in your state across the country. So, Michelle, I appreciate
I appreciate your
updating us. And is there a website where people can go to get more information on this?
They can look at Alliance for Quality Education. That's who I'm up with now. There's a group in New York called Parent Voices New York. They're based in New York City. There's also Change the Stakes. These are all wonderful, wonderful resources for people to go to.
Okay. We will put at least one of those up on at majority.fm. All right. Thanks again, Michelle Cupper. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
There you have it, folks. That is the... Well, I just got an email about this, actually, oddly enough. Let me read it. I haven't read anything about it, but this is from listener Eric. Hello, Majority Reporters. Yesterday, you mentioned you might cover the rally against Cuomo's proposed changes. Here's my two cents. As a special ed teacher who works with mostly students with learning disabilities and ELLs, English language learners from other countries, the proposal to make test scores 50% of our evaluation would punish me for choosing to work with kids from tough backgrounds who never do as well on standardized tests. The whole push towards standardized testing is motivated by privatizers like the testing companies who profit from this, not by any objective measure which improves student and teacher performance. Finally, charter schools dilute funding for regular public schools, have the advantage of being able to kick out lower performers, and even then don't actually perform significantly better than neighborhood schools, so their expansion must be stopped. Gladly tell you more if you're interested. a member, podcast awards voter, and faithful listener. This is from a public school teacher in Brooklyn, New York, from a high school. So there you go. Couldn't have said it better myself. Folks, this is really important for you to understand this dynamic that's taking place here, because I guarantee you this is headed to your state. And it's why it's so important for it to be defeated here in New York. We're going to go into the funner half, and I'm going to talk about the way that so-called right-to-work provision passed in Wisconsin, because there is a quality to both these fights that seems similar. There's a quality of sort of a neoliberal agenda that is progressing that I find disturbing. No, just by chance that we had both these stories on today. One, both happened to do with children in some respect, but really largely unrelated, but for the idea that there's a sociopathy, frankly, that is involved at the top of both these stories, or I guess with the power in both these stories, where children are used as a pawns or are irrelevant to someone else's agenda, the welfare of our children. And so just sort of a coincidence that it worked out this way. But we're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. Folks, make sure you vote at podcastawards.com. I know there was a problem with the email with some people. I don't know. It seems to be primarily AOL. People had a problem with the link. I'm not sure why that was. Some people had a problem with the email link or not.
If anybody's had a problem with the email,
we got just two or three.
I've seen those. I think they all were AOL.
You go to podcastawards.com. It's pretty straightforward.
Or it's linked on our homepage on majority.fm, or if you like us on Facebook, we're posting it every day there. So sorry about that if you're on AOL, but all those are the other ways you can get to it.
You want to be a part of the program? 646-257-3920. Hey, get the app. You can get it at majorityapp.com. It's free. You can listen to the show. You can stream it. You can download it. You can listen to it live. You can call me one touch on the program, or you can IM me with one touch. If you want to IM the show and you don't have the app, you can just use your instant messaging client and IM me at Majority FM at AIM, I guess. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. MajorityReportKickback.com. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it via our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. We get a kickback. Every time you do, you'll notice no difference. That's why we call it MajorityReportKickback.com. We would have called it www.majorityreportkickback.com. You notice no difference if you're buying crap from Amazon anyways. Buy it through our link, and we get a kickback.com. But that was oddly already taken, so we just called it MajorityReportKickback.com. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this. She shakes her head.
She says you're only afraid to be.